I found out, I don't think he's here with us today, but many of you know, and many of you know Buck. And Buck, you're probably watching online right now, because I know when he's not here with us, he's watching online. Buck is 88 years old today. He usually sits right down here, and if you ever see Buck in the next week, say happy birthday to him. Buck, we love you. We pray God's health and blessing on your life. Yeah. 88's a milestone, you know, double eights. That's amazing. Family. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Some of us have big families. Some of us have small families. Sometimes you look at other people's families and you can maybe sometimes be a little bit jealous. Sometimes you look at it and you're like, I wish my family was like that. I know for Catherine and I, you know, for most of our marriage, we've really not lived near family at all. We've always been away from family, either halfway around the world or in different provinces, or we might live in the same province, but we don't live in the same city, and so we're always away from family. And so sometimes, you know, when you look at other people's families, especially those that, like, they all live close to one another, all the kids are there, they live, and you're like, oh, man, that would be so nice. And there's other aspects, I know, potentially for you, when you look at other people's lives, when you look at other people's families, you might have a different feeling like that, where you're like, I wish, fill in the blanks. Interesting thing about family is this, and this is a quote I found, and you might have heard this before, but it says this: a dysfunctional family is any family with more than one person in it. No matter what family you look at, there is an element of dysfunction in that family. You might look at them and you might feel, man, they have it all together. What a perfect family. Like, it looks like they never fight. They never have any issues. It looks perfect on the outside. But the reality is that it doesn't matter what family you are in, there is an element of dysfunction. And the reason why that is because every single one of us as human beings are broken to a certain extent. We're broken people. We experience sin. We experience suffering. We experience brokenness. And that brokenness flows through our families. And there's not much that we can do about that other than ask God's grace to help us. We look to a greater God that will slowly change and transform us, and that his kingdom would come into our hearts. When we look at the Bible, it's no different when we look at the Bible. We look at families that are incredibly dysfunctional. That's the amazing thing about the Bible, is that it doesn't really cover that stuff. It doesn't make it look like it's all roses. It shows you the dysfunction. We're doing this series, you can put that slide up, called The God Story, where we're walking through the story of salvation. We're walking through God's story, his interaction with humanity from the beginning of Genesis to Revelation. It's going to take us some time. But in Genesis, towards the beginning of Genesis 11 and 12, we're introduced to a family that God chooses to use to display his goodness, and his plan of salvation is going to work through that family that's going to bless the whole world. This family is the family of Abraham and Sarah. If you see at the back, though, it's really interesting. There's all sorts of names there, and every single name that you see on that slide represents some fashion or form of dysfunction. When we read the stories of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Ishmael, there is dysfunction in it. And yet God's in the middle of that. We talked about Abraham last week. We got to the end of that story, and we're going to be walking through other stories. There's his son Isaac who marries Rebekah, and they have Jacob and Esau, and there's dysfunction in that as well. It's like they each choose their favorite son. Isaac, he likes Esau. That's his favorite son. And Rebecca chooses Jacob, and there's favorites that are chosen. There's a theme of favoritism that flows through this family and all sorts of brokenness that results because of that. Jacob, he ends up taking off after his fight with Esau, and he goes, lives up north with his uncle, and he ends up getting married, but he doesn't marry one woman. He ends up with actually like four wives. And there's so much dysfunction in that. And they have 12 different sons, as you can read on there. There's Reuben, there's Simeon, there's Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad. Oh, I'm running out of breath. Asher and Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph and Benjamin, the 12 sons of Jacob, the 12 sons of Israel. Jacob is renamed Israel by God. It means one who wrestles with God. Beautiful name, because the reality is that if you interact with God, if you have a relationship with God, there's going to be an aspect of wrestling with God. We're having to skip past a lot of those stories here today if we're going to get through this series of the God story. I can't touch on each one of them. But what I'm going to touch on is the second youngest son of Jacob. Second youngest son of Israel, Joseph. And even that, it's a little bit tough because the story of Joseph, and by the way, there's going to be Judah added in there because he's a really important part of the story, but it goes all the way from Genesis chapter 37 to 50. So really, we're covering 13 chapters of the Bible today. We're going to be skimming it in a lot of ways. But Joseph, when I talk about dysfunction and favorites and stuff like that, Joseph was the favorite of his dad, Jacob. Scriptures make it very clear that Jacob loved Joseph the most. As you can imagine, there's all sorts of problems that come about because of that. I'm going to take you to Genesis chapter 37. It says this. This is the account of Jacob and his family. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flocks. He worked for his half-brothers, the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day, Jacob had a special gift made for Joseph, a beautiful robe. But his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word to him. A lot of information in here. You have a 17-year-old boy. He's the favorite. He's a bit of a snitch. He's a bit of a tattletale. Something tells me this 17-year-old kid would annoy a lot of us. You know that one, it's like where whatever goes wrong with his brothers, he's right away running to mommy and daddy and telling them what's wrong. You can imagine how that would just grate and grind on his brothers. He's given a special robe. For us in the 21st century, this doesn't mean much to us. Maybe it would be like, you know, you have 12 sons and one son, he hits 16, 17. You're like, I'm going to buy you a brand new car. And all the rest of the sons got nothing. They grew up, they had to earn their own money. They had to buy their own cars. But this 17-year-old, he got a brand new car from daddy. What's the deal with that? Well, in the ancient world, this idea of a robe, it signified authority, it signified favor, it signified wealth. That's what this robe represented. And he gives him this special robe. Now, oftentimes within our culture and in the past, it's been represented by a coat of many colors, a beautiful coat. And the reality is, we don't actually know if it was a coat of many colors, to be honest with you. The scriptures actually don't tell us that. It could have been. But what we do know is that it was a special robe. He's hated by his brothers because of this. And then to top it all off, as we walk through the story, Joseph starts having dreams. He starts having dreams and he starts telling his brothers, his family, these dreams. And one of these dreams, he has dreams that they're out in the field and they're harvesting grain by hand. And they're putting them together in bundles, him and his brothers. And they put them in bundles. And in this dream, Joseph's bundle stands up on end. And the rest of his brothers, their bundles come and their bundles of grain bow down to his bundle. Can you imagine him telling that to his family? What do you think that means, guys? There's not a lot of wisdom happening in wisdom's in Joseph's life at this time. He has another dream about the sun and the moon and the stars coming and bowing down to him. I mean, the brothers are already looking at him going, like, this kid thinks he's something special. They don't think he's special at all. But then he's coming in with these dreams saying, oh, look at these dreams that I had. What do you think this means, the sun and moon bowing down to me? What is this? What do you think about that, guys? In the ancient world, dreams were really important. For us now, we have dreams and we chalk it up to like, well, I probably ate some weird pizza last night. Or, you know, psychologically, we know that like to a certain degree, our mind is sorting through the things that we've experienced throughout the day. And so we dream about those things. In the ancient world, they took dreams probably far more seriously than we do. And they believed that they communicated information to them from the divine realm. Stuff is happening in the spiritual realm, and when they would have a dream, they would automatically ask themselves, what is happening in the spiritual realm? What are the gods, or what is God trying to communicate to me? So the story continues, and Joseph, or I should say Jacob's 10 oldest sons are out with their flocks, with the sheep, with the goats. They're off taking care of them out in the fields, probably fairly far away from home. And one day, Jacob says to Joseph, Joseph, I want you to go and check on your brothers, make sure that they are okay. Joseph agrees, he takes off, and he starts wandering, kind of figures out where they're at. And his 10 older brothers, they see him coming down the road, all by himself, away from mommy and daddy. And that hatred that they have towards their brother is bubbling up, and they're saying, how about, can we figure out a way to kill this little rat? Let's take him out. Let's kill him. Reuben, the oldest, it's just so you know, like, we kind of sense this today, but in the ancient world, the oldest was there to make sure he took care of the rest of the family. And Reuben, the oldest, looks at what his brothers are talking about, and he's trying to figure a way how to save his brother, how to save him from death. But in the story, we don't know why, but Reuben eventually leaves, and the rest of the brothers take Joseph. They don't kill him right away, but they throw him into a cistern. A cistern is a big pit that stores water. And this cistern is empty. There's no water in it, but they throw him in the cistern, using it a little bit like a jail. Let's put him there until we decide what we're going to do with him. And as they're trying to figure this out, they see in the distance some traders coming their way. And Judah has an idea. And that's what it says in Genesis 37. It says, Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain by killing our brother? We'd have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to those Ishmaelite traders. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. And his brothers agreed. So when the Ishmaelites, who were Midianite traders, came by, Joseph's brothers pulled him out of the cistern and sold him to them for 20 pieces of silver. And the traders took him to Egypt. Things aren't turning out so well for Joseph, are they? When you look at this story and what's happening in his life, how he's being traded, he's being given away as a slave, there's two things that I see happening. Some of this is totally outside of his control. He's going to experience something traumatic in his life that is totally out of his control. But at the same time, he's going to experience something traumatic in his life that he's kind of had a hand in at the same time. He's not totally without fault. Isn't that like life, though? Each one of us experience suffering. We experience pain. We experience traumatic instances. Sometimes those instances are completely out of control. There's nothing that we could do to change it. But if we're a little bit honest with ourselves, we'd also recognize that sometimes those traumatic experiences we played a hand in. We can't completely blame it on everybody else. We have to take responsibility for our hand in it. And I think Joseph needs to do this in this situation. He's sold as a slave for 20 pieces of silver. In the ancient Near East, 20 pieces of silver was actually a fairly common going rate for a slave. That is what you would typically pay for a slave. It was about 2 years' wages. So it's a fair amount of money that his brothers is getting to sell him as a slave. You know what's really, really interesting about this story? Is over 1,000 years later, there's one named Jesus who comes. He's surrounded by his disciples, his friends, his 12 brothers or followers. And one of them, Judas, sells Jesus to the religious leaders to crucify him for how much money? 20 pieces of silver. Isn't that interesting? The same amount of money shows up in the Old Testament, completely different writer, shows up in the New Testament, completely different writer, and there's over 1,000-year gap in between it. Do you know that the name Judas is Greek for the name Judah? So in Joseph's instance, it's Judah, his brother, who sells him into slavery for 20 pieces of silver. In Jesus' instance, it's his follower named Judah, who sells him off to be crucified for 20 pieces of silver. But it doesn't stop there. The coincidences don't stop there. You know, Joseph goes on. He's sold into slavery, but eventually, as we'll see, this is, you know, you guys, most of you guys know the story, so this isn't a shocker to you, but that being, for him, Joseph being sold into slavery leads to the redemption and the savior of many people in the known world at that time. Jesus is sold for 20 pieces of silver and he's crucified on the cross, and it leads to the redemption and savior of the world. In literature, we call this foreshadowing. In biblical theology, we call this typology, that Joseph is a type of Jesus. Joseph is reflecting something of Jesus thousands of years before Jesus shows up on the scene. It's fascinating. And so Joseph is sold into slavery, eventually ends up down into Egypt, sold to a government official named Potiphar. And this is what it says in Genesis 39. The Lord was with Joseph, so he succeeded in everything he did as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this and realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything he did. This pleased Potiphar, so he soon made Joseph his personal attendant. He put him in charge of his entire household and everything he owned. Notice that Joseph is in slavery, and yet the scriptures say the Lord was with Joseph. Let me repeat that. Joseph is in slavery, you guys, and yet it says the Lord was with Joseph. We would typically assume in a story like this, and if we were experiencing this, we might ask ourselves, has God abandoned me? We might ask the question, maybe God doesn't care. But in this story, we see that even though he has been sold into slavery, it says God was with him. And God blesses him. He ends up in charge of the entire household. When things seem like things have gone from bad and things are just starting to get better because his life is getting a little bit better even though he's a slave. It goes from bad to worse. And the story says the Potiphar's wife has been watching Joseph and she thinks he's a pretty good-looking guy. And one day, she tries to get him to sleep with her. Come to bed with me. And in the story, Joseph takes off and he runs away, leaving his robe behind. Think about that. He was given a robe as a blessing, and now he's running away from his robe. There's a whole lesson connected to this that I can't talk about today because it would take forever, but what's really, really interesting is that Joseph is accused of rape and he's thrown in jail. So he goes from being a slave with a certain amount of freedom and now he's in jail for accused rape. And this is what it says in Genesis 39:21, it says, "But the Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love." There it is again. If you don't think that God has abandoned Joseph yet, if you think that God doesn't care about Joseph yet, now it's gotten even worse. Now he's in jail. And yet in the midst of this, it says that God is showing him his faithful love. It's saying that God was with Joseph. We tend to judge God and what he is doing so much oftentimes by our life circumstances. We look at our circumstance, we look at what's going on in our life, and we choose whether or not we think God is a good God. We choose whether or not we want to have a relationship with God based upon our circumstances. And so much in this story is trying to communicate to us that no matter what your circumstance is, no matter how bad it seems, no matter how much it seems that you have been abandoned and no one cares about you, that God sees you. God sees you. God saw Joseph. He was with him. And God was blessing him even in the midst of being in jail. Joseph doesn't just have dreams, but as he's in jail, there's all sorts of other people that are having dreams, and they're coming to Joseph, and it turns out that God has given Joseph a gift of being able to interpret those dreams. And so he starts interpreting the dreams of people in the jail, and God gives him favor, and before you know it, he's one of the guys he's still in jail, but he's part of the leadership of the jail in terms of taking care of it. Years pass by. He's no longer 17, you guys. Years pass by. He is an adult, and he's in this jail, and eventually Pharaoh ends up having a dream. And it's an intense dream for Pharaoh. He's never had a dream like this before, and no one can interpret the dream. He's taking it to his wise people, his interpreters, and no one knows what the dream is about. And finally, Pharaoh gets word, there's a guy in the jail, he can interpret dreams. Pharaoh's like, bring him to me. And Joseph stands before the king, the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, this is my dream, interpret it for me. And this is what Joseph says. He says in Genesis 41:16, he says, it is beyond my power to do this. Joseph replied, but God can tell you what it means and set you at ease. As we walk through this story, you can see a young man of 17 who doesn't have a lot of wisdom. And we're starting to see a progression of what he's experiencing giving him wisdom. First, he runs away from the temptation of Potiphar's wife. Wise. That's wise, guys. Doesn't turn out so well. Do you know that sometimes you're going to do the right thing and it's going to end up in the wrong result? You cannot measure the results of your decisions fully by how things turn out, whether it was the right or wrong thing to do. Sometimes God's going to call you to do the right thing, and you're going to get the wrong result that you don't like. And that's the situation with Joseph. And yet the Lord was with him. And he comes and he stands before Potiphar, and Potiphar's like, interpret this dream. And he has enough wisdom to say, you know what? I can't do it. He could have, he has the gift of interpreting dreams, and he could have said, yeah, that's me. I'm the man. Potiphar, if I interpret this dream for you, what will you give me? He stands before Potiphar and says, actually, I can't do this, but I know a God who can. I love the wisdom of that. I love the humility of that. It is God that allows us to do the things that we can do. And he interprets the dream. And he says, Potiphar, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be 7 years of bountiful harvest throughout your land. 7 years, you're going to have more food than you know what to do with. And then there is going to be 7 years of famine where there's no rain, there's no production of food, there's nothing. So this is the unsolicited advice I give you, Potiphar. In the 7 years of good, you should save up 1/5 of all the food you produce and store it away. Pharaoh's like, man, that's really good advice. Where'd the wisdom come from this slave? Where'd the wisdom come from this corrupt person in jail? Where'd all this wisdom come from? And he thinks to himself, I need someone in charge of this. Who could I choose? Maybe I should choose the smart guy that figured this out. Joseph, I'm going to put you in charge. You're going to do exactly what you just told me to do. You're going to be in charge of the entire country to save this 1/5 of food. Nobody is going to be above you except me. You'll be in second in command. It's so interesting, this story, right? I mean, he goes from the lowest of lows and now he's to the highest of highs. But how many of you know that no matter how much money you have, no matter how much power that you have, you can still walk in your life with a limp. You still walk in your life with trauma. You still walk in your life with pain from the things that you've experienced from your family and from the people that were supposed to love you the most. We could look at this story and be like, Joseph's all cool now. He's got all the money and he's got all the power. But he's walking with a limp. He's still dealing with the pain and the trauma of his life. And things come full circle because this famine that they're experiencing in Egypt isn't just going to happen in Egypt 7 years later. It's going to happen across the entire Middle East. And his brothers and his family and his dad, they're all experiencing the famine in Canaan. And they run out of food and they're like, Jacob's like, hey, boys, I need you to go down to Egypt. I've heard they have food there for you to buy. I need you to go down and buy food. And before you know it, the 10 brothers that sold him in the slavery are now standing before Joseph. They have no idea who he is, and they're saying, we need to buy food from you. The tables have turned. What is Joseph going to do? What is Joseph going to do? For a lot of people, they would say, now's the opportunity for vengeance. Now's the opportunity for revenge. But somehow in the midst of this story, that God has been doing something in the heart of Joseph that is changing him and transforming him. Something different is happening. Joseph never lets on that he knows who they are, but he sells them grain. In fact, he doesn't just sell them grain, but he blesses them by putting the money that they gave him for the grain and hiding it in their sacks of grain. He didn't have to do that. But he gave them all the grain for free, hid it in his sack. He wanted to bless them. There's two things that Joseph wants to do in this situation. First thing is he wants to bless his brothers, the ones who have hurt him, that sold him into slavery, that hated him. He wants to bless them. The second thing that Joseph wants to do in this situation, he wants to know, have their hearts changed? Are they the same people that they were? So he comes up with this brilliant idea. He's like, I think he accuses them of being spies. And he says, for you to prove that you're not spies, one of you is going to have to stay here with me until you bring your youngest brother here, Benjamin, to me and prove to me that you're not spies. So Simeon ends up having to stay back with Joseph. The rest go back to Canaan. They live their lives. They run out of grain. They're stuck. They need more grain. Now they need to go back. They need to bring Benjamin back to Egypt with them. And they show up. What will Joseph do? Once again, he blesses them with grain. But this time, he puts a valuable golden cup into the bag of Benjamin. And as they leave, he sends off his servants to go check on them because something has been stolen by Joseph. They look in Benjamin's sack, and he is the one who is, quote-unquote, stole Joseph's valuable cup. And they're all brought back to Joseph. What are they going to do? What is going to happen? I mean, this is so dramatic. Is Joseph going to throw Benjamin in jail? Is he going to throw all of them in jail? What is happening here? Joseph is standing back watching this whole thing, and he's wondering, how are my brothers going to react to this? Have they changed? Are they the same men they used to be, or is something different? He accuses Benjamin. Benjamin's going to be thrown into jail. And just as this is about to happen, Judah, the one who sold Joseph into slavery in the first place, steps up. And he says this in Genesis 44. He says, my Lord, I guaranteed my father that I would take care of the boy. I told him, if I don't bring him back to you, I will bear the blame forever. So please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. For how can I return to my father if the boy is not with me? I couldn't bear to see the anguish that would cause my father. You know, Benjamin is the next favorite in line, right? Judah, the same one who was willing to kill Joseph, who sold him into slavery for 20 pieces of silver, is the same Judah that now comes to Joseph, not knowing who Joseph is, and saying, I will take the blame. I will give my life for my brother. Once again, this is foreshadowing of what Jesus is going to do. There is one from the tribe of Judah, the coming king, the Messiah. His name was Jesus. When he looked across at humanity, who he knew is heading towards destruction and heading towards death, said, I will take the blame. I will give my life so that the multitude, so that you can live. And that's what Judah is doing here in the story. We're seeing a full circle of Judah's character. By the way, if you do read this story, there is a chapter, I think it's Genesis 38, that also talks a story about Judah as well. It seems like it's so out of place with this story, but it's not out of place because it's continuing the story of Judah and the transformation of his character. Genesis 45, it says this, Joseph could stand it no longer. There were many people in the room, and he said to his attendants, out, all of you. So he was alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. Then he broke down and wept. He wept so loudly the Egyptians could hear him. And the word of it quickly carried to the Pharaoh's palace. "I am Joseph," he said to his brothers. "Is my father still alive?" But his brothers were speechless. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. "Please come closer," he said to them. So they came closer, and he said again, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery in Egypt. But don't be upset, don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. This famine that has ravaged the land for 2 years will last 5 more years, and there'll be neither plowing nor harvesting. God has sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you." And then verse 15, it says, "Then Joseph kissed each of his brothers and wept over them. After that, they began to talk freely with him." For Joseph, this is so painful. He weeps. I mean, it says that he wept so loudly, it was like everybody could hear. Word of it even got to Pharaoh about his pain. This isn't just some happy story that has this beautiful, happy ending. This is a story of someone who went through incredible suffering and pain, and yet it was for a purpose. It was for a purpose. God used his situation because God could see the entire story. It wasn't just about Joseph. If God could sit down with Joseph, he would say, "Joseph, it's not just about you. It's about everybody. And I love you so much, Joseph, but I'm going to allow you to go through this because there's something I need to accomplish through you that's going to save the world." But it wasn't just about that, folks. It wasn't just about saving people so they wouldn't die from starvation. It was about Joseph's character. If you looked at the beginning of the story, he's a snotty little brat. And God takes him through these instances, and as you watch Joseph walk through the pain and the suffering and the trauma, he ends up on the other side. And he's a reflection of the heart and the love of God. He becomes somebody that is beautiful. Not on his outside, but on his inside. What is God willing to allow you to go through because of his greater purposes that you just can't see? Whether that affects other people, impacts other people's lives, impacts the world that you live in, or whether that just impacts you. Where he says, the formation of who you are is more important to me than the suffering that you're going to experience in your physical life. It's mind-boggling, and when we look at the scriptures and we look at our own lives, sometimes we can't wrap our minds around it, and we get angry, and we get bitter at people. We get angry and bitter at God, and that is how Joseph could have ended up. Joseph could have been that angry, bitter person at the end of his life that just wants to take out his pain on other people. As we say, hurt people hurt people. But this story is about someone who allows that stuff to form and shape him. By now, at the end of this story, he's probably at least in his early 40s. This is the journey from 17 years old up until at least early to mid 40s. This is where he's at. I want to share something with you guys when it comes to following Jesus and the discipleship journey. John Mark Comer writes a book called Practicing the Way, which is a book talking about following Jesus. And in that, he talks about something called stages of discipleship theory. Stages of discipleship theory, it is just a theory, by the way. But stages of discipleship theory is something that they talk about in regards to stages of following Jesus, the typical things that we go through as we follow Jesus. And these first three stages are stages that you'd probably recognize. It's stages that we emphasize in the church. It's stages that we do fairly well in the church. Many churches do it fairly well. First stage is recognition of God. That's the first stage in the journey where people recognize, oh, there is a God. I want to know him. I want to have a relationship with him. I'm going to commit my life to Jesus. The second stage of discipleship theory is called the life of discipleship. And this basically means the idea of learning the basics of your faith. Where maybe you've discovered God, you want to learn about God, and so you start learning about him through scripture, through going to church, through going to discipleship, through going to small groups and all sorts of things like that. The third stage of discipleship is this idea called the productive life. And that's when people say, I actually want to help now. I want to serve now. I want to get involved. I want to do those things. And in his book, John Mark Comer says, we do those things in the church fairly well, but then oftentimes we hit what's called a wall. If we can go to the next slide. And this is where oftentimes for as a church, we don't do so well. We don't do so well as Christians in this, the last three stages of this discipleship theory. Number four, they call that the journey inward or hitting the wall. And that's the stage of discipleship that a lot of people go through when they, at different points in their life, when they experience suffering, when they experience pain, they end up hitting a spiritual wall. And oftentimes people can go through what's called deconstruction, where they start in the midst of their pain, in the midst of their doubts, in the midst of whatever they're going through, they start deconstructing their faith. Sometimes people go through therapy, they'll go through counseling. It's a journey inward. It's figuring out what in the world is going on inside of me. What have I been taught? What have I experienced in life? And this is a very, very crucial point of discipleship. And oftentimes this is the stage where people hit the wall and they either are able to jump over the wall, push through the wall, or the wall stops them in their tracks of their discipleship journey. And they end up getting off the discipleship track. Because they can't sort out those things. They can't sort out the deconstruction. They can't sort out the suffering and the pain and the, whatever they've experienced in church over the years, whatever they've experienced in their families over the years, and it derails them. But there are others that if we can help them, they're actually able to get through the wall. Whether it's through or over or whatever that looks like, as you sort through the stuff of your life. And if you can get through that wall, then they start to reemerge in the journey outward where now they're able to get involved maybe in church again. They're able to get involved in a spiritual community again. They're able to give again. But that giving looks different the second time. Because whether we want to admit it or not, sometimes in the first stage where we hit stage three where we decide to give, we don't realize that we give with hidden motives. We're still asking, what do I get out of this? If I volunteer, if I serve, if I do whatever that is within the church, what am I getting out of it? And oftentimes people, they pull back from that stage after a while because they're like, I'm not getting anything out of this. But if you're able to push through that wall and you hit part five, that giving comes out of an area of your life where you don't need anything from it anymore. You don't need to receive anything anymore. Your giving comes out of your relationship with God. Your just giving comes out because you just love God. And it doesn't matter how people respond to your giving. It doesn't matter whether you get anything back. You just give out of that love within your heart. And then stage six, they say in the discipleship journey, most people don't hit until they're old. That's a stage where you've walked with Jesus for so many years that your life just exudes love. People just want to be near you because of your life. It's not even about what you do anymore. It's just about who you are. And if I can speak to like the seniors in our church right now, you do get a point sometimes in the church where maybe you feel like you don't give anymore, or you don't feel like you can give anymore, or maybe whatever the situation is, and you can become discouraged. But the reality is that you being you is the greatest gift that you can give. I wish Buck was here, because Buck is like that. If you know Buck, it's like, Buck, you don't have to do anything. Just be you. It's like when you're around Buck, you sense love. John Mark Comer talks about Eugene Peterson's life. And if you know Eugene Peterson, he was an incredible church leader, pastor, wrote books, wrote The Message. And he got towards the end of his life, and he's living in this little cottage in Montana. And church leaders from all over would come and visit Eugene Peterson, just to kind of be with him. He's at the end of his life, and John says that he was able to be here as one of the last people who visited Eugene Peterson. And when he spent time with Eugene Peterson, he said it wasn't even anything he said. He said he spent time with Eugene, and some of the things he said was kind of boring. But he said the point of being with Eugene is that he just exuded the love and the presence of God. You just wanted to be with him. That is the goal. That is the goal. But oftentimes we get tripped up by stage four. We get tripped up by the stuff going on in our lives, the pain that we've experienced, the hurt that we've experienced. And every single one of us, if you've lived on this planet long enough, you will experience that. I've experienced it. There's times in my journey that some of the greatest hurt in my life has happened by people in the church. It has. It's reality. I don't say that for you to feel sorry for me, because many of you have experienced that too. And you've experienced that and you're like, I'm done. I'm done with church. I'm done with this, that, and the other. But I would encourage you, God doesn't want to end there. He wants to do something in you in the midst of that. He wants you to bring all of that to him. And it's going to be a process. Sometimes when we talk about healing in the church, it's like this instant thing. Like we want instant healing. And sometimes it's a process of healing that God wants to do in our hearts that's going to take time. But if you give that to him, allow him, you will end up in that life of love. The pain turns into love. And we look at the story of Joseph. Man, it's like at the end, it's like he exuded with love. And you get to chapter 50 of Genesis, and his dad has died. Jacob has died. And Joseph's brothers are worried. They're like, okay, dad's dead now. What is Joseph going to do to us now? Because they were scared that maybe Joseph was just being nice to them because of his dad. Jacob's off the scene. They're like, uh-oh, what's going to happen? And Joseph comes to them and he's like, no, guys, I wasn't lying. I forgive you. I love you. The things that I experienced were for a purpose, and I give that to God, and I have peace in my heart. I have peace in my heart.